sound effects.
Interracial John with Drew and Leslie. Get the shit on. Interracial John. Shut the fuck up and listen. Interracial John. Interracial John. Interracial shit motherfuckers. Shut up and listen. Drew and Leslie. Interracial John.
Every once a month I gotta play it.
Oh my gosh, for those who don't know, that's my brother-in-law singing our theme song he made up for us, so God bless him. If you're just joining us for the first time, you are listening to the Interracial John Podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack, and I'm joined by...
Very white guy.
And you are very white indeed.
Especially now, mid-January.
Yeah, for sure.
Glowingly white.
Super white. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Interracial John. That's J-A-W-N. You can go to our website, interracialjohn.com. Of course, we're on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr. We're also on Periscope, where we host the Cooking John the first Tuesday of every month. We cook live on air on Periscope. You can watch us cook. Next month we're making pizza chicken.
Pizza chicken.
Really good. You can also leave us feedback. I'm going through these really quick because we got to get to our guests. So
you got it. Move it.
You can leave us feedback. We love feedback. You can leave us a whole bunch of different ways. You can leave us a review on iTunes or Stitcher. If it's 5 stars, we'll read it here on the air. You can send us an email, interracialjohn@gmail.com. You can send us a voicemail. Just pick up your phone. Dial 657-JOHNERS.
Beep, bop, boop, beep, beep, bop, boop.
That's J-A-W-N-E-R-S. If it's under 3 minutes and not crazy, we'll play it on the air. We also like to use the hashtag TheJohn for the show. And a special shout out to the Black Guy Who Tips, Karen and Rod, for our general feedback rules, which brings us to our guest.
Bing, bing, bing.
Who is the queen of podcasts herself, 10-star Karen from the Black Guy Who Tips podcast.
10-star? Is that... I like
that's
that.
Her official I know, bio, I know. Just FYI, which she does for her wonderful husband, Rod. Karen, we're so happy to have you here on the show.
Maybe I hadn't seen the official bio before. And I'm just laughing because you guys do the 5-star song when you're doing your...
the baller alert?
The baller alert.
Yeah.
So Karen's twice as good. 10-star.
That's facts. What's going on, Karen?
How y'all doing out there?
Oh, we are so happy to have you on the show. You've been here before, but it's always such a pleasure, and we're so honored to have you here. We refer to you as the queen of all podcasts, so yes.
I might say the hardest working woman in podcastdom, too. Because
I'm willing to bet that, too.
I don't know if a lot of people realize, like, Karen holds on to a job, too. Like, she got, like, a 9-to-5.
Yeah, y'all.
She's on 5-6 days a week with Rod, and she's... doing the full time,
and she jumps on the
John another podcast.
She's all over the place.
Busy. This is her day off. They don't record today, so
she's
came on our
here
show.
With us. So how about
unbelievable?
That? Just for you people, you should be thankful to her all the time. So what's up, Karen? How's life been treating you?
Life has been treating me really, really good. No complaints. I'm drinking because we was talking about the weather before.
Yes,
they were saying that the weather's supposed to get bad here, and I was telling you. I told my job that you ain't got to worry about me in the morning if the pretty white lady be slipping and sliding on the news. Like that's my litmus test. I wake up really early, and I watch the van that rolls out at 3 and 4 and 5 in the morning. And if the pretty white lady slips out there on the ice, I immediately pick up my phone and call. I don't care if you open, close, indifferent. I don't care. I'm not coming in.
Legit.
It's like a Winterland version of Punxsutawney Phil.
Yeah. It's Groundhog Day.
Becky
like,
Spill.
You know, Becky Spill. I like it.
If Becky spills, ain't going to work.
Ain't going to work today.
Mm-hmm. And it's never failed me. You know. And the thing is, a lot of times, I don't know. It's actually funny to me when I wake up early to watch them slip and slide on the van because I'm like, hey, if that's what the streets look like, what am I? These people are paid to actually be out on the street.
Right.
I'm not paid to be out on the street. I'm paid to get to the job. So I'm not going out there for free.
Yeah, you got to figure if you're a professional outdoors person and like you think you're equipped, like the snow is here and the male people have like tundra boots and like our male person, Roxy, comes in like a full like onesie.
She's like in like a full
head-to-toe suit.
She's and legit.
It's
in the streets.
It's USPS. It's from work, right? So if she's in all that and she's slipping and falling in cold, us regular people can't be doing
no.
Mm-hmm. If your profession is outside and you still fucking it up,
nah.
Us amateurs can stay home.
Yes.
Nope. Hey, have no problem.
I know you have a bunch of stuff to go into with Karen. You want to like talk to her or something, Leslie? Yeah. And I'm gonna do an audible because we were in Chicago this past weekend for a little bit of a vacation. A friend of ours had a baby shower, and we're sitting down. We're in the baby shower. This has never happened, and it kind of blew my socks off.
Oh yeah.
Someone walks up, like, "Oh my god, you're the interracial John.
Yeah, it was
the
first time in real
life.
To us.
In real life. Some of the, and me and I was like, did that just happen?
What happened?
That was really weird.
So the first thing we thought of was like, oh my God, this must happen to Karen and Rod all the time.
And so as I was talking to Mary, and we'll talk more about it another time. Mary's, you know, I don't want to say stalking us. But
what's up, Mary?
We know her, hey, a few Mary. Other people, so it was okay. But I said to her, I said, oh, you know, I listen to Rod and Karen's show a lot, and I talk to them a lot. And podcasts have this sort of like intimate conversation between a couple that other right. people passively listen to. And when I started thinking about it, I was like, Jesus, I've probably like mentally, how, you know, 1,000+ hours of the two of you talking. That leads me to conclude that I know you.
Right.
Like I have in my mind, like, oh, if I went to Carolina, me and Rod, can't we be like best friends? We go to a Panthers game. I get a fucking hot dog in here. It'd be awesome. You
we
know?
Go to Bojangles. We go to Bojangles. It'd
be dope. But like, that, of course, that's not really it. But like, that's how I think Mary kind of probably felt in a little bit like to us because she's listened to all the shows. So I wanted to ask, like, what is, you know, being the queen of podcasting like? Do you get recognized? Are people like, oh my God, Black Eyed Peas, I love that show? And then they, do they ask like weird stuff? They think they know you? Like, how does that go?
It's weird, but I understand. It's one of the things where I had to get used to it. Mm-hmm. And one good, quote unquote, good thing about podcasting is that a lot of times most people recognize you by your voice quicker than they will your face.
Right.
You know, but like you said, because they constantly hear your voice. So they might recognize a laugh or, you know what I mean, or something like that. Like, people may recognize your face if they, because we do a lot, we do live shows.
Right? Sure.
Right. So if people see us on,
Spreecast, right?
Spreecast and yeah. things like that, they might recognize our face. I think that I had to get used to it. It's very different. I think the thing about it is that I'm an extrovert, so it's not as bad for me as it is for Roderick. And I don't mean bad in a bad way. I mean, Roderick is an introvert. So for him, when he meets people, it's not bad. It's just different, if that makes sense. Because like introverts, they're less likely to be as open, if that makes sense. A lot of people think that something is wrong with introverts, so they don't speak. It's not that. It's just the fact that once you get to know them, they're very open and very warming. And a lot of introverts are some of the best people and best friends you will ever meet. But a lot of it is just getting past that wall that they have, you know, because they keep things to themselves and think in their heads a lot. And I think, like for me, the first time it happened, me and Roderick, we was actually eating with a bunch of our friends. Cause the thing about it is that, more people on the internet and things like that know us than like know that we podcast than in real life. Most people, we don't even mention or say anything about it because most of them don't know what it is, don't understand. Or either we said something, they go, yeah. And they'll move on to other topics because, you know, as big as podcasting is, the average person does not know Jack.
Sure.
It's true. Like, they have no idea. Yeah. You guys are famous, like, straight up famous.
Well, not just that, but, like, even in our own life, like, you know.
Oh, nobody that knows us listens to our podcast.
However many dozen and a half listeners we have, it's never anyone that knows us.
No.
And the one person that did, like, oh, yeah, I listened to this episode, and they referenced something from, like, a year and a half ago. I'm like, oh, thanks.
And I think for me and Roger was sitting eating one time, and I think it was like a friend of a friend, and he was like, yeah, that's Karen, you know, hey Karen and Rod, you know, I know you from the show, and it's been a few years ago. I was like, wow. I was like, it's one of the things, but initially you don't know how to respond. Because you're like, okay, because you're like, for the first time in your mind, because when most people podcast, they podcast out of the enjoyment of podcasting.
Right.
Not really to become big, become famous. Some people do, don't get me wrong. But the average person podcasts out of the enjoyment of venting, out of the enjoyment of a platform that they can talk and speak and be open on. And out of that forms friendships and relationships and things like that, which can be a great thing. But, you know, like you say, we interact with most of our fans via social media.
Mm-hmm.
So when you interact with people on social media, that's completely different than interacting with them face to face. I think a few weeks ago was hilarious. Me and Roderick was eating at a Qdoba's, and I was sitting there eating, and this girl walked by. I didn't see her because my back was turned to it. This girl right by, and she was staring at Roderick, and Roderick looked, and he was trying to figure out, you know, do I know you from high school? Like, where do I know you from? And she was like, hey, Rod. Hey, Karen. And I turned around. I was like, hey, sweetie. And I think
sweetie, you gave me the sweetie. I'm sorry. That killed me.
And I think that she thought that she was going to bother us. So when I turned around, I said, "Hey, how you doing?" She's like, "Okay, I gotta go. No, 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 no." And she just ran off.
She's starstruck.
I was like, I wanted to take a picture and all that, but she just ran away.
That's awesome.
Before we could say anything, like, you know, it's like, we're not going to bite you or anything like that. But I think that she was like, I just don't want to come over there and just invade, you know? And so, for me, it was a fun experience. And then she went on social media, which was hilarious. I was like, oh, that's so sweet.
Wait till you guys are ordering like Popeyes in fucking California. You're going to be like somewhere totally like nowhere near home. And you're going to go to like a drive through and order some shit. And somebody's like, are you Rod and Karen from the Black Eyed Hoochies? Just the voice. That'll be a trip.
But I know what Rod feels. I'm an introvert. I don't really like talk. I actually don't like people, generally speaking.
You know, this is a little known secret. You hate people.
I really do.
I'm fortunate.
It's facts. I don't like people at all. Despite what I do for a living and all, if you call it that, and all of those things, I don't like people very much. And I'm great talking. I'll talk to huge groups of people, but when it comes to like actually interacting, like, I don't like it. And I found that the more activism work I do, the worse it is, because I really don't want to get into these deep ass conversations with folks half the time, because they're going to say something left, they're going to say something off, they're going to say something that's going to like really set me off, and I just don't want to even deal with it. So I just start to like, nah, I'm not going to go to that. Nah, I don't want to go to that party. No, I don't want to do that either.
I mean, we're back home, and I've got family in Chicagoland, so we had a little get together, reunion of sorts. Probably been, I don't know, a decade since all of us have been together like that. But, you know, I kind of had to keep my thumb on the the activism dialogue, just sort of like, you know, like, well, what are you doing? Let's not just talk about what Leslie's doing all day.
How about that?
Long.
How about you don't make me have to talk about the things I do? So you mentioned Qdoba. Rod posted a concerning photo today. I think he was in Chipotle.
Yes, he told me.
I don't want to drop dime, but I was, you know, people right away was like, ooh, I'm telling. Immediately on Twitter, ooh, I'm going to tell Karen, like right away. I was like, I'm talking to Karen tonight. I'm definitely saying something.
That's like the diarrhea roulette. Like.
So I just wanted, he's still alive, correct? Like he has nothing. Yes, okay.
So far, he's alive. So far, so good. Not feeling anything like that. And I told him, you on your own. I told him, I'm not going and I'm not eating it. And he thought it was a game. I was like, no, people are getting sick and going to the hospital, sir. No, I like my food to stay down. I don't like IVs. I'm good.
And if you're ever, like, they have that game, like, you know, would you rather this or that? Like, death from, like, dysentery, dehydration, because it's coming out of both ends, that's got to just be miserable. However, the end is awful, you're dying, but the, like, moments and hours and days before your death are, like, crippling and horrible and, like, vomiting and diarrhea. No, thank you.
Mm-mm. Yeah, no. I love myself, you know. I don't know what to tell them about that, you know, because he's not the only one. There's a lot of people, but, you know, it's just one of them things where I'm not gonna, like, it's like a Russian roulette, you know, with your body, because most people go, you're not gonna have a problem, but the time the disease hit the store, it's too late.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it's early to have the nomination for the show name, but Diarrhea Roulette. We'll just put a pin in that maybe. I don't know. We'll see.
So what have you been watching? What's been on your radar of late? TV? All these fucking shows came back this week. It's like overload a little bit.
Yeah, I love this time of the year because all the shows are back. We watch a lot of TV, and Roger watches more TV than me because he has time. Like, it's so many shows, I don't have time. So a lot of shows I have to catch up on the back end, and then I'll start watching them live once I catch up. Some I never catch up. Some great shows I literally have to tap out because I'm like, okay, I will never watch anything if I sit down and watch this. So that'll be something that I'll have to watch 15 years later because, you're not trying to funny, I just don't have time.
Right.
Because I think right now, this week starts all the shows. We watch Supergirl, we watch The Flash, we watch Arrow, we watch Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. A lot of people watch Agent Carter. I hadn't watched the first season, so I can't watch the second season. I'm actually catching up on Mr. Robot before the second season of that restarts.
We should go back and watch that. People really loved that.
Which one?
Mr. Robot. I watched like three episodes. That was all I did.
I watched the first episode, and it is excellent. It really grabs you and draws you in, and everybody that has watched Mr. Robot raves about it and says how really, really good, and the main actor, kudos to him, when the, I think it was the Academy Awards, a few weeks ago, Mr. Robot swept. I was like, that's when I watched the first episode, I was like, that's why I swept, because it's just amazing. And it's one of those things where the way the story is told, it'll make you really, really think about now. It'll make you think about how much intelligence is out there, how much we're giving away, how much people can really track your life digitally and things like that.
I want to go back and check that one out.
Yeah, so I really like Mr. Robot. We actually a show called The Expanse is a sci-fi.
Love it.
Oh, we like that one.
Yeah, we really enjoy that one.
That show is crazy. They are not afraid to kill fucking people on that show.
I like that one because it's different. And the thing on the low sci-fi, I got some great stuff. Right now, I got a few more episodes and I'll be caught up on 12 Monkeys because we watched 12. 12 Monkeys is actually an excellent show.
That show is so good.
I think that's some of sci-fi's best work.
Right. 12 Monkeys is excellent. I haven't finished watching I got like a few more episodes and I wanted to catch that up before it restarts in April. And I think a few more. I think let's see.
Well, and shout out to our last guest, Chris Fett, who does Insanity Tech, Movie Trailer Review Network. Leslie, you did a 12 Monkeys recap of the whole season.
Yeah.
And Karen, I'm telling you, like the show's good. It's really good. The last like two or three episodes has a payoff for like especially I think the binge watcher.
Yeah,
like there's the one where he's like, he said, the one dude, I don't know if Karen's guys don't want to spoil it, but the one dude's like, man, you're sitting right here, like, you know, that scene, that whole episode into the end, honestly, it blew me away. But like it handles time travel better than any show I've ever seen.
Yeah, it really does.
That's what I've heard, and like I say, I'm got a few more episodes to go, and like it is one of the few shows that I really started watching on sci-fi, and that's what kind of branched me off into The Expanse, which I really, really like. We also, trying to think, what else is restarting? I think Fear the Walking Dead is getting ready to restart up soon.
Yeah, that's right.
Valentine's Day, oddly enough.
Yes, somewhere around in there. And so I'm excited, and I am so ready for all the shows. Our DVR is getting ready to get full back up again because we really love to watch TV. And you know, I kind of hate the downtime with those 2 weeks. I understand that people need those 2 weeks to kind of catch up and all that stuff, but now up to the point where television is year round, and I think
it's great. And I feel like I was telling Drew, like, I'm shocked. Maybe it'll happen the next year or two, but if I was putting a new show on, I would play my show those 2 weeks every night, knowing that it has like almost nothing up against it. It would be such a smart strategy.
It would be a long play because you're not going to get the ad money for that.
Yeah,
that's
an
off week and stuff.
But I know, but if it's a show that's owned by the network, I feel like they could really get a lot of viewers to watch a show.
And I agree with you, Leslie, because the thing about it is that doing those 2 weeks, all jokes aside, there's nothing but bowl games on.
Yep.
So if you don't watch football, what is there to watch? I'm not trying to be fun because everything else is on reruns. So, and it's like true. You say, if it's something that the network owns, it's not really, they're not really taken out of their pocket. If
right,
that
right.
Like, so if do those 2 weeks, if they had a quote unquote 2 week special that they play a new episode Monday through Friday for 2 whole weeks, it would be one of the number one rated shows because, like she said, it's nothing else on, it's nothing else to watch, you know, because now you done got to the point where, okay, it's quote unquote January, all your shows get ready to come back. And then you start talking about the summertime. Now the summertime is being taken up because you have shows starting in April and May. And they drag through the course of the summer now. And now you have shows, now your other shows re-pick up in August. And something the shows started to do, which I didn't really like, but now I'm kind of accustomed to it, is those mid-season breaks. So now you get half of a show in 1 year and half of a show in another year. You know, which kind of makes sense now because you actually get more longevity out of the shows versus here go all 24 of the shows, all such other shows. And I think networks have become smart about trending. So it's one of those things where you want your shows to trend.
Yep.
You know, and I think that Legends of Tomorrow starts
coming out
too.
You know, though, that break, I feel like, at least for me, we binge watch a lot of stuff. We catch up on things, Netflix shows where they're all released at once, and I think to that how stations and programming and content can maybe change based on the viewing habits. I think we've seen a lot of that. Like, there are shows that only run in the summer. The Closer for a while used to do three or four episodes right in that break. Remember, Leslie? Like, when The Closer was kind of like catching on and trying to get more people, they would come out with, you know, two or three episodes in the middle of December when no one else was on.
Well, The Expanse, first four episodes, even before they air, they put them all on demand so people could binge watch the first four, which we did, actually. We ended up just sitting and watching all four of them. And then we, obviously, now we watch every week because we got hooked on it. So it's I think we've seen a lot of these networks start playing around with the traditional model, which is great. I think it's really fantastic. I mean, truthfully, they're going to have to do something because Netflix,
are moving. Yeah.
They're changing the game out in these streets, like on the real between Jessica Jones. They got Daredevil coming back out. Luke Cage about to hit the scene. They are on some other level shit.
I can't say how, and I want to give exact, but I know specifically that on the largest internet provider's network, Netflix accounts for like, oh, for fuck's sake, like 60% of their bandwidth.
Listen, we went...
Just Netflix.
We went to a hotel this weekend in Chicago. They had Netflix on the TV. On one of the channels on the TV was Netflix. They let me log into my Netflix and just start watching it.
That was dope.
They had
smart. That's smart because it's one of those things where people travel and they might not want to carry their devices, not chummy funny. They might not want to carry their sticks that you plug into their TV anyway, because that's what they, you know, because people watch things. I guarantee you they will say, well, hey, we have 40 to 50% of people that take their stick and plug them into our TVs. Yes. Why don't we allow them to just log in? I mean, I guarantee you things like that are happening. Or either we see that they're bringing their Xboxes or they're bringing their PlayStations, you know, when they travel or they're watching on their laptop.
No, you're talking to us. We do that. We literally bring a Bose SoundLink speaker, a 3.5 millimeter audio cable, and then a cable to go from a laptop or a device, usually to like a, and I've got two different ones, an old school like RCA to the red, yellow, and whatever cable, and then a more modern HDMI one. And we'll bring it to a hotel and pull our shit up, play it on the speaker, put it on the big screen. Some hotels now will lock those ports, like the way to plug your device in, they'll put a metal bar over it and lock it down because they want to sell you shit. But
this was, you could log into Hulu, you could log
Netflix,
YouTube, Pandora, and YouTube,
and Pandora,
directly on there.
If you
it was
accounts.
Amazing.
And it makes sense because you know what? You'll remember the name of that hotel, and next time you travel, you'll want to rebook there out of that convenience.
Absolutely.
And listen, if you don't have an account, they gave you a free one on Pandora for 7 days, but you had to give them your email and address and shit. So look at that. They get a lead.
Mm-hmm.
It's a win-win-win.
So you can't complain because most people don't stay at hotels for 7 days. You're only there for a few days, then you're off to the next one. And hotels that actually block that, they are actually hurting themselves because you're going to make people mad, and they're not going to want to come back.
Exactly.
Yeah, was it Marriott or
AC, which is Autograph Collection. Marriott.
Autograph Collection from Marriott.
It was definitely like all linked up.
It's
with everything.
I would call it like their attempt at a boutique.
Boutique, yeah, kind of thing. It was nice though.
It was cool. Well appointed. Right. Should we get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
The news is coming on. The news is coming on.
And I won't let Shirley's keep going on and on.
Please stop.
So Google's cardboard virtual reality device saved a baby's life, according to the internet. Identical twins Tegan and Riley Lexon were born in August. Doctors told the parents that Tegan, who was born missing a lung and half of her heart, wouldn't survive for long, but the condition seemed inoperable, wouldn't be able to do anything without a miracle. Thankfully, after some months, doctors in Miami gave her some hope of a chance. They wanted to operate, but their 3D printing machine wasn't working, and they had some, you know, ability to use this virtual reality cardboard from Google, and they got the surgery done. So the hospital got creative using CT scans. They converted the image into a digital three-dimensional model, which was then made compatible with the Google Cardboard Viewer.
Wow. So which you use your phone, right, with that? Isn't that what it is?
Yes, it's really – and I'm bummed. We should have done it. Verizon was giving away for a while, but I think maybe for like 10 or 20 bucks you – ship out, and they send you a piece of cardboard that's like a puzzle, and you put it together and build it, and it's got maybe one nut or one little piece, and then you put your phone into a slot designed for it, and then content that's played specifically for this virtual glass looks 3D.
And it saved the baby's life.
I would say it's safe. I mean, it's a little bit much.
Well, I mean, it did because they wouldn't be able to do the surgery, right?
I mean, maybe they could have gone to another hospital and printed it. You know, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not saying like it was nothing other than this Google Glass. They just got creative and used the cardboard Google to do it.
So my question for you two is, when will Google become sentient?
When will it become
When will it just go full Terminator 2 on us and be just, because I feel like they own, they have their hands in everything. Now they have their hands in surgeries. I mean, this is getting out of control.
Yeah, I really think that they already do. They already watch us. They already map us out. They already have their vehicles rolled up and down the road, monitoring everything that we do from the satellites and things like that. And I think that it's good and it's bad. It's good because it makes the world smaller. It's bad because I do believe in privacy on mm-hmm. certain things. I don't believe that every single solitary aspect of my life needs to be on an open platform or forum for people to judge and criticize. Because, you know, you're dealing with the internet, and that's all the internet does a lot of the times. And I think that there needs to be people that continue to fight the fight of privacy, you know, because everything can't be open forum, because what people fail to realize, it's cool until you're a victim of domestic violence. It's cool until you're a victim of a stalker. It's cool until, you know, you're a victim of a harasser mm-hmm. who can easily pull your name up and find your address, telephone number, social security code, and everything about your life. It's cool until then. Yep. And then once they start harassing you, the laws of the land have not caught up with the internet. So everybody acts like the internet is just something that they just, I have no comprehension of what the fuck that is. And, you know, you have to fight like hell to get restraining orders against people for stalking you on Facebook, stalking you on Twitter, like literally stalking you. Yep. And so that's kind of the downfall of that. I don't mind it, but it needs its boundaries. Like I said, it really does, because now everything is so open. And not only that, you have people, especially when you talk about the Black Lives Matter, and once you start talking about people that are fighting for, especially brown people, people of color, their justices, LGBTQ, their justices. You have a lot of people that are white supremacists who mm-hmm. actually do this same thing. They yep. actually go and find these people and stalk them and follow them around and harass them, you know. And I think that people's safety does matter to me, you know. And so I do understand it, and I think it's already sentient. I think that if anybody ever tapped and really, truly found out everything that they knew, people would be scared.
And that's what you just said. That's me, right? Like, I think, like, well, I was Googled this too much, too that. They already, the things that the NSA and Google and other companies can do, just let's talk about marketing. The way that they can target information to you from an ad standpoint, like you search something on Amazon and then like 5 minutes later on like whatever website.com, there's that shit you just searched for on Amazon from a different person for sale, right? Like the ability to target. They know I've been told if they know your age, zip code, and a few other pieces of information, they can like tell you what color car you drive. Like they know so much about you. And now they're tying it more together with patterns and behavior, so they can do shit with this metadata that like today is kind of scary. I wonder, what are they going to do with this metadata tomorrow? What is this, you know, huge enormous amounts of data that we're not able to crunch? Computer processing hasn't gotten to the point to be able to look at this, you know, trillion terabytes of information that is generated, you know, whatever. Like I forget the, again, Moore's law is how fast a computer processing, it doubles every, I think, year, every 6 months. There's something in terms of content, like over the last, I think, 5 or 7 years, we as a human race have created more content than the entire written history before it, right? So like we're creating just massive amounts of shit, and we can't crunch it, but there are going to be computers at some point that are going to crunch it. They're going to crunch it in real time, and they're going to be able to see shit that, like, I don't know what they're going to see, but, you know, the thing that for me was the tipping point was when Google made was it Google Plus? What do they call that shit?
Yeah, Google Plus.
And they even admitted, like, 18 months later, you know, like, is it really working? Are people using it? And he's like, well, and all the metrics that matter, meaning people logged in and gave them the fucking name and gave them a fucking, you know, like, I told them, hey, this is me. I'm Drew. This is what I look like. This is my email. This is my IP. They got to fucking connect all those fucking dots to all sorts of other shit. And it was no secret that in order to have any Google account doing anything, you had to have the Google Plus horse shit. And they just now got rid of it. Literally, like, well, we, you know, maybe we got enough on enough people that we can shut that down. But it was just a data ploy.
You guys are talking about the scary part. Like, for me, like, I think about people, like, the three of us don't have this problem. I think about dating, right, in this age. And I think I would never date anybody given the amount of information that's out there for folks on the internet. Like, I feel like a simple search would yield for almost anybody on the planet, a reason not to date them. And it, I can't imagine, like, I just feel like you have too many opportunities to, like, not look past the, like, dumb picture of them in Cancun that's on Facebook or whatever might be up there. Whereas, I don't know, when we were dating, it was like, you didn't have all of that. You got to know the person, then you learned about their embarrassing stories, and now it's like everybody's embarrassing stories are, like, out there in the world
for everybody to see.
And to me, that's a generational thing.
Yes.
Like, I mean, not trying to find it. Like, how you feel is very generational because we didn't grow up on that. But when you're living with a generation that grows up with touch screens, grows up with iPhones, grows up with Androids, grows up with Skype, they grew up in this. They grew up with high-speed internet. They didn't have to ever deal with dial-up. Mm. You know, when you're dealing with a generation where your life is already being digitally tracked from elementary school and they're having lawsuits – And people are suing because people are telling the school systems not to monitor digitally monitor children's life like this, because if something happened and somebody hacks and somebody breaks into this, all of a sudden, everything about this child, from suspensions to everything else, shit that should be private and locked up, all of a sudden becomes public.
Right.
You know, and that becomes a problem. And I think that for me, if I was in this generation, I don't think I would be scared if I was of this generation, but I'm not. I'm like you. I'm older. So for me, I would Google you. I would see if you could buy a pack of gum. I would see what your credit looks like. Mm-hmm. I would see, like, I'm going to, that's one good thing about now, because could you imagine years ago you dating people? Yes, we got to know people, but guess what? You still have to get to know people today. I don't care how many times we have phone sex on Skype. It never tells me about you as an individual person. I don't care how much we FaceTime. I still have to get to know you, and that's something that only time will tell. If you're crazy, time will tell that. But see, now sometimes you can weed out crazy before I ever meet you face to face. Years ago, you know, you didn't have access, which is a good thing, to all this information where I can Google and see if you committed crimes. I'm not trying to be funny or see what you've done in your past, good or bad. I can see that, and I can make my judgment off of that, and it gives me a chance to decide if this is something that I'm willing to deal with, versus I get in a relationship, we've got deep in it, and then you throw this shit at me.
Exactly.
On the backside. You know, so it's good and bad to it. Yeah, like for me, I love my husband very much, and it's because I'm older. I've told him, if anything ever happened to you, I don't think I would ever get married again. I'm just keeping it real. I love my husband. I love my husband with all my heart. I don't think I could ever commit myself to anybody like that again, because everything is so open, because it's to the point to where people aren't truthful anymore. Not that everybody was truthful back in the day, but, you know, now people want to hide, they want to cover, you know, because you have the internet.
Yep.
You know, people want to go into these fake identities and all this stuff. So for me personally, like I said, if anything happened, I don't ever think I would remarry, because, like I said, me and my husband, we grew up together. That's completely different between that and you meeting somebody later on in your life.
Yeah, our associate producer, Carl, the O'Johnner, he's on them streets, Dayton streets, and he was telling us about some of his URL tales, and I love him, but I want no part of that. So don't leave me in any capacity, Leslie, please.
All right, I'll make sure I don't. Yeah. Maybe not. We'll
couldn't
see.
Do it. Couldn't
still,
do it.
Still under warranty, so we'll see what happens. Speaking of warranties... Listeria found at Bluebell plant again.
Yeah, I saw that headline.
Again.
I was like, didn't they have Listeria already?
Lord, Brenham, Texas. Listeria has once again been discovered at a Bluebell plant. The Texas-based company said they wouldn't say which of the three facilities that it was found, but that it wasn't in the ice cream.
It's contaminated ass water, yep. Right? Isn't that what Listeria is? Like, really, like, bad water?
In April, it stopped distribution. 10 cases of Listeria reported in 4 different states. 3 people in Kansas died from it. Died.
Bluebell, damn.
And they said in a statement for this time, we expect to periodically find microbiological indications in our facilities. No batches of ice cream found to have tested for Listeria. And on December 28th, they announced that it would begin phase 5 in the coming weeks, which means that Tennessee, Alabama, Georgia, Kentucky, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia would start to see Bluebell ice cream back on the shelves. And my question is, Karen, will you be eating Bluebell again?
No.
You're done with Blue Bell.
No, I don't believe it. And you know, and all jokes aside, you know, to be the Mr. Conspiracy Man, it wouldn't surprise me if that was an employee of the company or employee that worked for the company in the past.
Is a carrier and maybe isn't ill, but
somebody's doing something there. Because the thing about it, like, I don't like being sick. You know, and it's funny, though, when you talk about these outbreaks and the government steps in, it's funny how a lot of people want to fight against the FDA, and these people's whole jobs is to protect the general public. Could you imagine if we didn't have these huge, large industries there that be like, hey, y'all can't be killing people, dog. You know, like, y'all can't be doing this. We have to come and investigate you now. Like, they're doing the investigation with Chipotle. Yes. People are dying, you know, because companies, let's just keep this real, most companies don't give a fuck about the consumers. They just want your money. They don't care about you dying or living or indifference. They just want you to come back. So it's just one of those things where when they cut the funding and shit like that, you prevent them from doing their job, which is to protect the general public.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe Rogan Fear Factor 2016, eat Blue Bell at Chipotle. You gotta eat like a Blue Bell. You gotta eat like three different Blue Bells and a Chipotle. All together. Fear Factor.
Hilarious. Yeah.
That's
speaking Blue of Bell. Consumer.
And speaking of, I guess, was it Listeria was found in Flint as well?
No, it wasn't Listeria. It's lead poisoning, babe.
No, but I thought there was cases of Listeria in Flint as well. No, it was a Legionnaires. Forgive me. Got my L's confused. They had Legionnaires disease because of lead poisoning. But so Mayor of Flint, I guess they dubbed it an awkward question, but it's one that we don't need to answer. So the inquiry into whether such a water crisis, I don't know if I like calling it a crisis. I wish we could use the word poisoning, maybe. But if such a crisis would have gone unmitigated for more than a year if it had affected rich white kids, isn't only awkward, it's rhetorical. So it's a great article, but the Washington Post, Wednesday, classified this as a awkward question that no one wants to answer. Inquiry into whether such a crisis, high levels of lead detected in cities' water supply, would have gone unmitigated for a year if it affected rich white kids, isn't only awkward, it's rhetorical. No answer is needed because for decades, even centuries of social precedence, the communities, a hard American truth, black lives, poor lives more specifically, are disposable. They are not nearly equal in value to a life full of richness and whiteness. Flint, Michigan, just outside Detroit, is got 10% unemployment. 4 out of 10 residents are unemployed or in poverty, so 40% living in poverty. It's about 57% African-American community. But the mayor said it's a minority community, it's a poor community, and our voices were not heard.
This situation in Flint is just insane.
It's awful.
It's awful for so many reasons. It's awful because one individual, not elected by officials, were given the opportunity
state
of emergency to make decisions for this city that have led to irreparable damage to their children and their health and well-being. I'm upset and dismayed because the state knew about this condition for over a year and said nothing, continued telling folks to drink this water, to bathe to use it to wash their clothes. And, you know, these are lasting effects. And then, you know, the secondary piece of it is that there's no solution in sight. They have no idea what they're going to do.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they thought was going to happen is what I don't understand. This is where I have a problem connecting the stupidity of the decision to the outcome of their actions, because at some point they had to know that this was going to be an issue for folks, that at some point it was going to be pretty obvious that people were getting violently ill and children were going to have brain damage, and that this was unhealthy for folks. So
they did this for the equivalent of, like, honest to God, like, not even $1,000 a day, you know, like a couple hundred dollars a day is the difference between Flint and Detroit water, which is what they did. They switched to the Flint River. And I think we've talked about it on the show, but if people aren't aware, the water is acidic, and that acidity in the water eroded the coating on these lead pipes that had been there for years and years and years, you know, decades. So now the lead is leaching into the water. And even, I think we talked in the last podcast, it's so much worse than even, like, what we think we know about the lead levels is self It's from the EPA in Michigan or some group in Michigan, and they were telling residents to flush their pipes for 5 minutes before taking the measurement and then to take the water at a slow flow rate so that that would, you know, deliberately suppress the amount of lead that might be, the parts per billion. So the water is so much worse than we thought. And like you said, the only solution is repairing all the pipes. And this weekend I was talking with a relative of ours who thinks that it might end up actually being fiscally cheaper to just put filters on the water for now and forever. Every single individual, every pipe, everywhere you go gets a, you know, some sort of filter that filters out lead particles because that's the only thing. What are you going to do? Replace every pipe?
But it's such a, like, we see this time and time again. You know, I know people have been saying, oh, this is Michigan's Katrina, and I don't like any comparisons to Katrina because there's nothing that compares to it. But I will say that much like Katrina, we see, again, these environmental emergency issues affecting black, brown, poor people more than the rest of the population every single time.
Half of all black residents in the state of Michigan, half. One out of every two black residents in the state of Michigan lives in a city that's under emergency management control. And as Leslie said, means the governor appoints an individual, not elected, appoints a single individual to make financial and other decisions for the city. Half of all black residents in Michigan.
And you remove the power that the people have when you have somebody that isn't even elected to office. So folks in Flint couldn't even say, we don't agree with this decision, so we're going to kick you out of office. There's no one to kick anywhere.
Yeah, they complained instantly.
You have no recourse as a citizen, and you have no body that is incentivized to listen to you. Have you guys been hearing much about the story, Karen, in South Carolina, or has it been?
Yeah, we've been hearing about it, and I think for me, I'm just going to be real. When it comes to brown people and poor people in our country, the best fiscal decision is not to care, because a lot of times when it comes to most brown people, they do gerrymandering and they rearrange the districts and they'll redraw the lines so that a lot of these people that have majority poor, majority brown, and they are white people in these areas too, but they draw it where their voting power doesn't matter. And a lot of times when your voting power doesn't matter, you're not the top priority when it comes to things like this. I think at the end of the day, they didn't care about the outcomes, repercussions, because a lot of things that affect us directly, a lot of times doesn't make the news. Nobody cares. It's like goes underneath the grain, even with a lot of this social media. And I think that the good thing about social media is that once enough people heard about this particular incident, it brought it to light. But we're hearing about it a year and a half after it has already been there. So yep. That means that you have this long period of time where it was not on anybody's radar. And I do believe that if this would have been white people, they would have not spared any dime, and those pipes and stuff would have been dug up. They'd have been replaced. They'd have been put down, because the people pay taxes to live there, and they don't pay taxes to die. You know, that's not the purpose of it. And I think that a lot of times people use excuses, because at the end of the day, most people, especially people in power and authority, they quote unquote find reasoning and they find excuses not to care about people that aren't in voting blocks or quote unquote don't have power. And it's one of those things where they fail to realize that it causes a divide in the country when you have a lot of poor people being ignored. Because Roger said this, and I agree, very, very rich people, very, very poor people have the same thing in common. They have nothing to lose. And when you're dealing with people that have nothing to lose, they go to the extremes. And when they go to the extremes, it's never pretty. When rich people go to the extremes, they go, fuck you, and then they throw all their money at everything.
Ain't that the truth?
Go to the extreme, they go, fuck you, and they riot. They go, fuck you, and they tear stuff up. They go, fuck you, and next thing you know, you got all types of problems because of poverty.
Mm. You know, the rich, when they say fuck you, they've got a lot more, I don't say leverage, but you know, they can say fuck you and really put a lot of, when they cut a community off, you know. And again, this whole Flint water crisis, when you're like, you're talking about, you know, like inequity and rich and poor. It doesn't even make sense to me, like the decision that they made, like just you know, the only way to make that decision is because you just, you're heartless, you don't care, and you think nothing of the individuals that you're there to, you know, you're a crisis manager taking care of a community of individuals, and you make a decision that's literally killing people, it's poisoning people, and the effects of lead poisoning, especially in children, they're irreversible. That does like permanent like brain and neurological damage to children for the rest of their lives. That is a cost, you know, like, I'm not trying to say that. Literally, like, not trying to make like a fiscal argument, but like this dumbass made a decision for a few hundred dollars. Maybe, I don't know what it was, $1,000 a day. It's not even going to come close to the cost to the state of Michigan for all the lives they've fucking ruined. Right. You know, like, and just why? I just can't wrap my brain around ever that decision being like, okay, you know, and so blasé about it and then denying it. Ugh.
And I can, because at the end of the day, you have to follow the dollars. I'm not trying to be funny. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
And when you're looking at it from a place of compassion, when you're looking at it from a place that these are individual people, when you're looking at it as a place that you're denying their rights, no, these people's decision is not going to make sense. But when you're looking at it completely fiscal, it makes sense. Is it heartless? Yes, but it makes sense. And that's why businesses are not people, because they don't care.
Yeah, and you know, that there's a, to that point, not to go like tangent on it, but a lot of my, you know, friends and people I hang out with are a little bit more radical when it comes to anti-capitalist views, and it's hard for me because I work in a environment, I work for a business that makes money, and part of my job is selling shit and making money, and you know, like I'm not saying like I'm an evil capitalist, but like, you know, I handle like lots of money and shit happens because of me, and it's like, so I'm not gonna be like, you know, down with capitalism, but you know, on some level, like, and the company I work for and the person I work for is awesome and great, and he's, you know, not a Republican and not like a greedy capitalist at all. He's a really good guy. But the, when you think of it, like, I don't say that capitalism like the root of all evil, but you know, it's pretty fucking bad. Like, you know, the fact that you can make decisions that completely fucking pillage and rape the earth and people, the environment, and fucking all sorts of shit so that you, an individual, makes a little bit of money. And any sort of problem that may arise from that, you can payola the right Congress people and slip right under the radar and continue to make tons and tons of fucking money. You know? And like, and nobody really cares because you're making money and everyone's making money. Like, that's kind of fucked up.
Yeah, and I think for me, at the end of the day, a lot of the decisions make sense because this great country of ours that we live in has never gotten over slavery. And once you understand that, all the decisions that are made make sense. We have never gotten over slavery.
You got a real point there.
Most people at the jobs that they work, if your company could pay you nothing, they would. That's why when you work at places and they pay the minimum wage, they would go, bitch, we'll pay you pennies if we could, but the government has set a standard. So a lot of times people fail to realize, since this country has never gotten over this, that's how you come up with these problems. Because at the end of the day, you look just like those Indians. You look just like those slaves. And even if you're white, you look just like the poor white trash that was out there picking cottons with the slaves that we paid a little pennies per hour just because we could. Because the average white person did not own slaves. A lot of white people were poor, and a lot of people don't want to talk about this too. There were a lot of white people that were absolutely positively poor, but when they went out there, they actually got paid a little bit, you know, but the black people got paid nothing. You had white people that were actually could have the right to go and steal black people's things because of the color of their skin. And once you, if you really want to get down to it, a lot of the problems with Flint and a lot of the problems across the country, and the reason why we have a lot of ghettos is because of housing practices that they had back in the day. They had certain areas that were in the suburbs years ago that they would tell people, do not allow black people to move into these neighborhoods. Because years ago, it used to be mixed. And a lot of these places, especially up there with like the cars and things like that, you know, out there in Detroit, big car manufacturer, when they had the plants, black people and white people, everybody lived together. But once they started marketing towards these white people and they started shipping those people out, their money left these areas. And when their money left these areas, their money never came back. And money matters. A lot of these poor places, there's no balance. You have all these poor people and you don't have rich people there to kind of balance that. And yeah, people want to hear that, because the thing is, the people care about money, and they have to be a balance. And I think more neighborhoods and everything actually need to be more mixed. They actually need to be more diverse, you know, because if there was that, you wouldn't have these places that were just completely famished.
Well, and Flint's a victim of the auto industry manufacturing, you know, shifting manufacturing overseas. And in fact, the Forbes had like the however many 20 worst places to live for black people. They're all right here in the Rust Belt, all, you know, former manufacturing, not necessarily cars, but, you know, textiles and other different manufacturing base. But to your point about the country never getting over slavery and tying into my comment about anti-capitalism and seeing capitalism as an evil in some ways, you know, I don't know if I'm saying this exactly correct, but like slavery is kind of the economic engine that drove capitalism and this country to greatness, right? Like slavery's like it's the fuel that got all this going. Like people, I think, and Jim Michelle Alexander talks about this in the Jim Crow. But when people are talking about the Industrial Revolution, they're frequently talking about cotton. You know, they're talking about again slavery and driven. And when you say we haven't gotten over that, the practices that built those sort of that logic and thinking and that sort of, you know, brutal capitalism, I should call it, rather than just like, you know, because people say, oh, America's this great democracy. Like, is it a democracy? I don't know if it's a real democracy. It's like pretty close, but I don't know if we're a true democracy more than like quasi democracy oligarchy. But, you know, in a genuine capitalist free market, you know, the capitalist company can be really like brutal. And, you know, slavery was really brutal. Capitalism can be really brutal. I think you see some of those vestiges in how corporations treat the labor pool. But,
Yes. We're going to go into another slightly obnoxious and irritating segment now, which I like to refer to as Girl
Please.
One more time.
Girl Please.
Okay, oh, what's this doing? Sorry. my jingle palette broke.
Oh, no. So over the weekend, while we were gone, actually, like right before we left on Thursday and Wednesday night, I got wind of this book called A Birthday Cake for George Washington that Scholastic had put out. I'm going to read the description of the book real quick. Everyone is buzzing about the president's birthday. It's a children's book. Okay, Karen. George Washington's servants. Now let's stop there. We're not talking about servants. This book is about slaves. So let's,
ma'am.
This is the descriptor, though.
Servant. Yep.
Especially George Washington's servants who scurry around the kitchen preparing to make this the best celebration ever. Oh, how George Washington loves his cake. And oh, how he depends on Hercules, his head chef, to make it for him.
Head chef? That's a...
Hercules, a slave, that's an aside, takes great pride in baking the president's birthday cake. But this year, there's one problem. They're out of sugar. That's the problem? The one problem? They out of sugar, y'all. This.
I'm sorry.
I can't make this shit up.
That's the one problem.
I can't make this
Damn
shit
it,
up.
If only we had some this sugar year, to bake Master's only. Cake. Golly.
This story, told in the voice of Delia, Hercules' young daughter, is based on real events and underscores the loving exchange between a very determined father and his eager daughter, who are faced with an unspoken, bittersweet reality. No matter how delicious the president's cake turns out to be, Delia and Papa will not taste the sweetness of freedom. New York Times food writer Raman Ganeshram and acclaimed illustrator Vanessa Brantley Newton serve up a slice of history in a picture book narrative that will surely satisfy it. And both of these bitches get a Girl Please from me.
The extra one.
Girl Please.
Oh my God, my head hurts so bad. Oh, I immediately responded because I really can't believe this shit is happening again. Folks that don't remember, last fall, actually, into winter, a book called A Fine Dessert was released, which featured four vignettes, a children's book, about the making of a dessert, the Blackberry Fool. And one of them, it had a slave and her daughter making this dessert, all smiles as well, and eating, like licking the spoon after making it for the family in the big house, like secretly in a corner. What the fuck is wrong with these people with this? And I use the hashtag slavery with a smile narrative that we are trying to feed our children. Someone wrote to me that it was psychological warfare against our children because this idea that that anything on, I don't even know what to say. I'm going to let you talk.
You know what? So you should put on the show notes your Storify. So what happened immediately, this is Wednesday, you catch wind of it, and we're all going on vacation the next morning. And you tweet about it. You tweet, like, you know, you rant it. You're like, oh, my God. Boop, 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 boop. Tweet it, like, I'll let your words speak for it, like 8 or 9 tweets. And we go to bed, and we get in the car, and we go on our thing. And you're like, oh, geez, that's a lot of retweets, like, you know, a couple hundred or something. And I can't remember if it was from there, maybe the next day. You have a friend, Ronnie, that was also discussing it, and you connected with – who are the individuals that are going to be on the podcast?
Well, Ronnie is going to be on, and also Edie Campbell, who is an educator and a book critic, and also who's the third person? I can't remember. And Mickey Kendall is going to be on as well to talk about it.
That's the Ferguson Response Podcast. Because you're going to talk a lot about it. I'll let you do more in depth about it.
Yeah. And I actually just want to mention it because I just want people to really understand the depths that supremacy will go to rewrite the ills of our history, of our country. And it's such an insidious, low key way of treating black people badly now by diminishing the pain of black people then.
Well, and we've talked on this podcast that trauma, like slavery and the Holocaust, can survive in DNA, right? We know this. We've talked on this podcast about a plantation tour guide and the questions the plantation tour guide would receive, including, well, it wasn't that bad, was it?
They were nice to their slaves, weren't they?
Still, it was better than being homeless, being a slave, right? They got fed and had shelter. It was pretty good to be a slave, right? Like, these are questions he'd get, right?
Right.
So we know that that's already the, bullshit-ass narrative. And now it's a children's book? And it's the second one in, 6 months to do the same horseshit? And I think sometimes a hashtag can do more than anything. And slavery with a smile is, that's about as a fucked up, effective hashtag. The fact that you fucking need that hashtag is grotesque, but it's a perfect hashtag.
The Girl Please is really going to the author in particular because she wrote a response to all the criticism.
Oh, didn't she deactivate her Twitter account?
She did that too.
Oh, no, I can't do it. Oh, my God.
No, don't do that. So she is a woman of color, but not a black woman. So I'll start with that. And a couple of these things, I just want to get Karen, I want to get your hot takes on her points as to why things are fine here. Why she thinks this is perfectly fine. She says, yet the discussion and criticism of the book has been focused on the literal face of value of the characters. How could they smile? How could they be anything but unrelentingly miserable? How could they be proud to bake a cake for George Washington? The answers to those questions are complex because human nature is complex. Bizarrely and, yes, disturbingly, there were some enslaved people who had a better quality of life than others and a close relationship with those who enslaved them. But they were smart enough to use those advantages to improve their lives.
And that's even if that is true, that's the story that needs to be told. Get out of here.
Karen, what are your thoughts on all this?
I have a lot to say about this. It's one of the things when it comes to history, most of the time, the people that quote unquote win ends up telling the stories.
Yep.
And when the people win tells the story, a lot of times you don't really get the entire truth. You get bits and pieces of it.
Yep.
And a lot of things are whitewashed. And it's amazing how you don't want to tell the truth about slavery. You don't want to tell the truth about Jim Crow laws. You don't want to tell the truth about these things that are written in history. You know, our Constitution says that we were 3/5 of a person, but yet at the same time, you have people that want to just deny that slavery even existed. But yet when it comes to the Holocaust, the thing about it is oppression is oppression. But when it comes to the Holocaust, it's never forget. When it comes to the Holocaust, you will show dead bodies to children. When it comes to the Holocaust, you make them watch Schindler's List. Yep. When it comes to the Holocaust, we will never forget. When you come to the Holocaust, we have museums. Anything about slavery, a lot of times, has to be in certain areas or certain places, you know, and people actually fight a lot of times against people that actually talk about these things because they're facts. And the thing is, I'm not about oppression Olympics, but when it comes to things, everybody is sad. They treated the Indians bad. Because they literally stole their land, gave them through casinos and a limited amount of land, and was like, y'all be free. And when it comes to us, we didn't even get that much. We didn't, you know, it's other people that we have done atrocities against in our country, and we paid them some form of reparation.
Yep.
But yet, when it comes to us, they don't want their reparation. You know, you don't want people to get paid for their years of working for free for many, many generations, them being bought here against their will, you know, and it's funny how because America doesn't want to face the reality that slavery was not pretty. Slavery, you know, a lot of people don't really understand the concept in this generation. They don't really understand the concept of owning a person, physically owning a person. And I see how people treat their cups of coffee. What the fuck are you going to do with another human being? Let's just keep this real.
Yep.
And so for me, and the quote unquote, the truth of that story is that slave ran away. He ran away.
He sure did.
he ran away on his birthday.
But him to be somewhere where it's happy and it's loving and he's being treated right. And oh, the only problem was sugar. Why the fuck did he run away? Because he was a slave. And they didn't talk about a shout out to Christian Sandy Chat because he made me just dig into this. Come to find out, they had a time limit on how long you could own slaves, and then the slaves had to be free. George Washington would actually ship the slaves back to his homeland and bring them back just to reset the clock on them so they could technically never be free.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's one of those things where if you want to sit down and really, really talk about the truth, woman, it's just one of those things where you go, you're sugarcoating it and you want it to sound pretty. So not only are you fooling a lot of white people who don't care, you're fooling a lot of black people about their own history. Yep. Because for some reason, it's okay for Jews to know their history. It's all right for them to know their history. It's all right for us to shame people that that did these atrocities against the Jews. If you better not dare say hell, Hitler, they'll fuck around and put you out of this place. But you can call somebody a nigger all day and all night long. You can hang flags. You can wear shit on your head. And it's not a motherfucking problem. I see a difference there on how the oppressed people are being treated. Now, this is me on the outside looking in. And the thing is, when you miss, because the thing is, it's okay for their children to be informed, but it's not okay for our children to be informed. Because the thing about brown people, when we get power in our hands, power and knowledge is dangerous to us, because power and knowledge is some of the ways that we got free.
Yep.
And like I said, once you go back to slavery, what did they not want you to do?
Read.
They didn't want you to be educated. They didn't want you to know how to read. They didn't want you to know how to write. They didn't want you to know, because the thing is, once you knew these things, you understood these things, you could manipulate the system and you could get the system to change and you could cause ruckus and you could cause white supremacy to end. And see, that's the problem with today, because today we're in a place where we have a lot of knowledge at our fingertips. We have a lot of social gatherings, and we're able to see these injustices at a mass that we never had before, because a lot of people are like, well, this is the first time I'm seeing this. No, these things have always happened in the history of America. People have been dying left and right. But you know what? Now we got studies and statistics, and people are like, I don't want to deal with this anymore, and I'm not going to deal with this anymore. And it scares people when black people graduate at a higher rate, particularly black women graduate at a higher rate, you know, than most people. Anyway, let's just keep that real.
Yeah, shout out. You and Leslie, Karen, I don't know if you knew this, black women are the most educated group of individuals in the country.
Right.
It's fact. Fact.
And want me to tell you why? Because at the end of the day, knowledge matters. And that's the thing that scares people. Knowledge is, if somebody has knowledge in their hand and they have wisdom in their hand, they're able to shape and change the world. And that's something that they don't want. Because if you're able to shape and change the world, the status quo has got to go. And it's also one of those things why a lot of white people and a lot of white supremacists in our country, and it's funny though, it's a lot of white people that support white supremacy and don't realize they support it in the things
all
they
day.
Do, the things that they say. Yep. And when you look at the academy and you look at how everybody says, I'm not racist. Okay, you as an individual person is not racist, but as a collective group, yes, you are.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, and that's that binary view of racism. We've talked a bunch on the show. My new go-to is just, well, you're maintaining the status quo of supremacy. You don't think you're a supremacist. You don't think you're a bad person, and I'm not calling you a hooded Klansman running around burning fucking crosses. I'm not saying that. I mean, that's what you think when I say the word racist. So instead, I'll say, listen, your behavior is that of which maintains the status quo of supremacy. Whether you think of that as supremacist behavior, whatever you want to call it, but you're in alignment with supremacist thinking and speaking and acting and, you know, and hit shit. I do it. I'm a white male. I wake up, you know, like, I'm not saying I, like, so for me, when we talk about it, and again, I try to be specific, I do less harm to people of color than I used to. And I hope in the future I'll do even less. I don't know if I'll ever get to know. I don't think zero harm exists for a very white guy. Maybe, I don't know.
And I think that the other thing with Karen, what you were talking about, which was that history is written by the winners, is part of my problem with this author, why she's specifically in the girl please category, because she finishes her little diatribe saying that she's upset that people are trying to make it because of who wrote the book. And she says this and these couple of sentences. This is a reductive and divisive subterfuge that misses what should be the only point about legitimacy. If you do the deep research, ferret out the facts and are true to them, then you have literary authority, regardless of color or ethnicity. When you write from your singular perspective or purely from imagination and pass it off as history, the authority is not yours. Listen, bitch, let me tell you something.
So I'm sorry, she's saying that she did the research, so it doesn't matter.
First of all, she trying to the Scholastic tried to pass her off like, oh, she's a Washingtonian historian. She's not. She's a food historian, and she claims that in her research she thinks that Hercules was the first celebrity chef. He wasn't a fucking celebrity. Mm-hmm. Okay, he was a slave that was allowed to do specific things for a very narrow period of time of his life.
Because
once George Washington realized that people could escape from Philadelphia much easier than they could from his farm in Virginia, he shipped Hercules' ass right back to Virginia full time, pulled his nice clothes, put him in field clothing, and had him out there lifting fucking bricks day in and day out in the wet, cold nastiness of Mount Vernon, Virginia. And that is when he ran away. So don't come at me talking about you're trying to be historically accurate. Let's be real. The much more historically relevant story is Hercules' escape from Mount Vernon, not this bullshit story about George Washington's cake.
And guess what? He escaped on his fucking birthday. Like, this is about his birthday cake. He escaped on his birthday.
Hello.
And how long did it take you to discover that fact? If you didn't know it, how many Google searches does that take? Is that page?
I didn't even need to. Somebody sent it to me because it was discovered by historians in Philadelphia in 2010. It's not even like it wasn't just discovered, and it's very well known because it was because people didn't know what happened to Hercules, and they discovered actual farm records that noted Hercules absconded on this date, the date of Washington's final birthday in office in Philadelphia, because people were in Philly and they were making a big deal about his birthday, and it was a good time for him to leave. So the whole thing irritates me because you're trying to rest on the laurels of history. You don't even have history right, first of all. Secondarily, of course it makes a fucking difference who's telling the history, because you, as a non-black person, think that any fucking record that you read from 1796 has taken into account anything about Hercules' actual feelings, Hercules' actual demeanor, is bullshit. Because a black person would know that anybody who wrote anything down about Hercules in 1796 didn't give two fucks about Hercules.
Come on now.
Was a white person.
Didn't give a shit about Hercules. And for you to take their narrative and assume that that's exactly what happened, that right there is why you shouldn't be telling this story, sweetheart. That's exactly why you need to sit the fuck down. And I'm glad that Scholastic pulled your goddamn book off the shelves. And I've already heard the rumblings. People have been tweeting me because apparently I spearheaded this effort or whatever, saying that this is censorship and it's so terrible and we should let the books come out and then let the chips fall where they may. Fuck you, because you don't have your little black and brown children reading this divisive, nasty, disgusting bullshit that makes it seem like us being enslaved people was good for us. It's disgusting is what it is. It's gross.
And I don't know what about getting beat, getting whooped, getting raped, being brought here against I will. I do not know what it is being put in chains, being put in bondage. I don't know what it is about being stacked on top of each other in boats and being shipped across the water. What is it about that's good? What is it about that children and families being split and continue today to be split because of our justice system? What about that is a good thing? And it's just one of those things where when you sit down and you really, really think about it, me and my husband went to Charleston a few years ago. And when we went to Charleston, I didn't know this, just out of, I won't say lack of knowledge, but just it never dawned on me that Charleston was one of the biggest interests of slaves on this coast. Like, yep. People would dock in Charleston, mm-hmm. and then they would kind of go up and down this coast. And so when you go there and you begin to see the roads and the street and the cobblestone, because a lot of that stuff is preserved in its original way. And once you go to, they have a museum, and in the museum, it's like a slave museum. And when you go in there, it literally is life changing, because yeah, you hear about slavery, but once I went into this museum, y'all, and they actually had chains, mm-hmm. that the slaves wore. They actually had audio of the slaves, audio of the slave masters. When you look on the walls and you see the original documentation that told you how much a child was worth, how much a woman was worth, how much a man was worth, at which age. When you read this stuff, when you see this stuff, and when you realize that people look just like me, yep. were treated like this, and when you also realize that when you have motherfuckers like Donald Trump spewing that fucking hatred that he's spewing, mm-hmm. and why I am fearful that he's gonna fucking get elected, it's one of those things where you go, this is where you want the country to go back to. And I understand that I live down south, and I understand too that a lot of these motherfuckers, they're goddamn racist. I'm just gonna keep that real. And when you look at it, you go, this is where you want to take me back, and I refuse to go. And me telling you, don't kill my children in the street, and me telling you, don't kill me if I get arrested and go to jail, me telling you that causes fear, because see, all of a sudden the rules change. And that's one thing where a lot of the anger comes out, and a lot of the anger is spewed, because a lot of times for a lot of black people, it's a lot of anger that kind of sits on your heart. And not only for you, but a lot of times I can't speak about anybody else, but I would sit back and listen to my great aunt, great great aunts, great great uncles, my family members that were like 100 years old before they passed, and them telling me about slavery, and them telling me about the Jim Crow laws. I got family members. History is not truly history, nope. until people that actually lived these events died. Mm-hmm. I have family members today that are grown that can tell me about Jim Crow laws, baby. So it ain't really history. And when you look back at it, and when you really think about it, civil rights was like 50-something, 60-something years ago. Yep. That's not a long period of time, mm-hmm. for people to be free, and for people to act like the hook that's sunk in our country and the hand that operates things is going to instantly change. Yes, we have laws in place, but just because you have laws in place, the heart of the people have got to change in order for the overall action to change. And I think for me, that's where a lot of the anger and a lot of the frustration come in. And the thing is, you know, I'm to the point in my life where I'm getting old and my fucks are gone. Mm. So it's no more explaining to you why I have the right to live. It's no more explaining to you why I shouldn't be harassed. Mm. It's no more explaining to you, because you should have empathy and sympathy for me because I am a human being. The color of my skin should not matter, because when I look at you as a white person, I look at you as an individual person. I do not look at you as a group. But every time I'm looked at as a group. Things are placed upon me that I never asked. I never asked for you to look at me and assume that I had 18 children. I never asked for you to look at me and assume I was on welfare. I never actually looked at me and assumed I was a single mother. I never asked for those things, but those things are placed upon me because the way the system is designed. And once people open up their eyes, their lives will change. And the thing about it is that a lot of white people are voting against their own interests. And the reason why I say that is because these policies and these rules and these procedures Donald Trump and stuff are coming up with, these are going to hurt you guys too, because what people fail to realize, most people will never be rich. And so since most people will never be rich, when you vote against things like healthcare, when you vote against things like unemployment, when you vote against these things, you're taking away your own safety net. When you vote against these things, you know, a lot of people feel like Obama's healthcare plan, which a lot of people fucking rant and rave about, is the reason why some of them even have healthcare. They fail to realize that Medicaid and Medicare is the government handout that, yes. you claim these poor people are getting. You know, and so for me, it's just one of those things. But I open up my eyes and I begin to look at the world in a whole different light. And it's one of those things where I know I may come off as angry and as upset. But the thing is, this is my reality. When you don't have to wake up and have the fear today, when I step outside my door, am I going to get a shot? When you don't have to worry about walking into your office place and claiming if I have a bad day or if my face frowns, am I going to lose my job? When you don't have to worry about those fears, when you don't have to kiss your children upside the head and send them off praying that they don't get shot, praying that a police officer don't arrest them, and all they're trying to do is get back and forth to school. You know, it's one of those things, when you don't have those worries, you can write this bullshit book.
Yep, exactly. And then try to explain it away. I just don't even, you know what, let's move on, because
it's not even better. So I saw this on Twitter, and I didn't get the full lowdown. Leslie, do you have it? Cops in Minneapolis were urging people to run over Black Lives Matter protesters?
So this one cop. Now, first of all, we just finished talking. Karen just broke it down for us about how our online lives are full of information for people to gain access to. Right, Karen? You just broke that all down for us.
I got to give like a... I secretly, low key, Karen. I'm like, man, I hope we get some topics from Karen. Can have like a, like, she's not like a, I don't call it a rant. That's like mean, but like, where Karen can really like get into her groove.
Yeah.
That was a sick groove. Oh, and yes, when you brought it all down, then you can write that fuck ass book.
Yeah. Right after
like,
that
was like a read of all times. Then you can write that fuck ass book.
Right.
Okay.
Then you can write it. Yes. So, in St. Paul, Minnesota, A police sergeant is facing an investigation after he reportedly encouraged drivers to run over Black Lives Matter protesters at an upcoming rally.
Of course he did.
On Facebook.
Wait a minute. He did it on Facebook?
Yes. J.M. Roth's now deleted Facebook comment. Of course.
Now deleted. What a brilliant move.
Of course. He deleted it, but, you know, the screen caps are forever.
He says...
Forgets a lot.
Oh,
of people,
yes,
realize that.
That's like if Black Twitter had like a motto, it'd be like we got receipts.
Yes.
Like
just like receipts are just coming. Like,
just, hashtag we got receipts.
That's the name of the episode, by the way.
We got receipts.
We got receipts. So he says, I'm gonna read the receipt real quick. He says, run them over, keep traffic flowing, and don't slow down for any of these idiots who try and block the street. Here's the deal: you continue to drive, and if you hit someone, make sure you call 911 to report the accident and meet the cops a block or two away, and you can justify stopping further away because you feared for your safety, since in the past people in this group has shown a propensity towards violence. Since they are trying to block the street and or cross where there is no crossing, you should not be charged with anything. Now, these idiots could try and sue you in civil court, but remember that it will be a jury trial, and so most likely it will come out in your favor.
Whoa, dude, he broke it all the way down like fucking
Andrew. Hit. Yeah, Henderson is this gentleman.
He really thought it all the way out, dude. He was like, here's a fucking easy reader, like primer, like 1 through 9, how to fucking run a person over. For real.
I'm sorry. Andrew Henderson is the person who found this. He often videotapes police officers at work to hold them accountable. He's one of these cop watch folks, and he found the post and pulled it. J.M. Roth, is the name. Sergeant Jeffrey M. Rothecker is the name of the gentleman.
Good for you, Andrew. Cop watch. Thank you.
Yeah. Of course, the St. Paul Police Federation is representing him and standing by him.
Oh, the FOP defends them vociferously, blindly, and completely, unequivocally.
Yeah.
So is he on administrative leave?
Yeah,
leave?
They have. He's facing an investigation. He's on basically desk duty, but he's still getting a paycheck, y'all.
He's not even on paid leave. He's on just desk duty.
Yeah, they're going to investigate themselves.
Yeah, and that's sad, but that is just one of those things where I don't expect things to change until the standard quo changes. Mm-hmm. And the thing about it is that's why people need to continue to fight in different forms. Because the thing is, I think that a lot of people are criticized because they might not do what you do, Leslie. But you know what I can do? I can repost the fuck out of a post.
Yep.
And do some shit on Facebook. I might say, you know what? I give my money to you, because no matter what you do, everything needs money. There's different forms of helping. It's just one of those things where people just assume that if you're not out on the street, that you're not doing anything. And that's not always true, because, you know, some people might say, I don't want to be arrested. I don't mind protesting, but I'm not willing to take it to the point that I have a criminal record. Absolutely. And there's nothing wrong with people who feel like that. But a lot of times those people people make them feel ashamed because they want an activist check. And the thing is, there's certain levels of activism. And it's just one of those things where, like, me and Roderick, we do not call ourselves activists. And people better realize, like, no. I see what activists do, and I see how they're treated. I am not an activist. I support them, and I push them, because I know that them doing their job allows me to have the freedoms that I have. Them being the face of something is okay. Because that's the thing. Everybody else has to be the face. Guess what? Somebody got to be the feet. Somebody got to be the toenails. Somebody got to be the eyes. Somebody got to be able to smell things. Somebody got to be able to hear things. It's a whole body of people that form this thing. And it's just one of those things where whatever your part is, no matter how big or small, it matters.
Absolutely. I mean, I say all the time that, you know, the strength of this movement is that we all are asked to look at what gifts we can bring and bring those gifts to it. And that's the long and the short of what the ask is, really. And for some folks, it's amplifying things. For some folks, it's money. For some folks, it's all sorts of different things. And I, you know, there's frequently situations where I go into it and I'm like, you know, I'm not willing to get arrested here because I don't think it's a worthwhile action, or because it's just not a good time for me, or because there's other stuff going on that doesn't make sense. You know, people go into situations and actions, and they actively have to decide, am I willing to go get arrested for this thing? And it's a conversation that's had when you're planning actions. So I completely agree with that. But the thing about that post that he made was how detailed he was and what the person was going to do. It wasn't just run them over.
No,
it was like,
all the way.
Here's what you could hit them,
step. Yeah.
Move to here,
no,
say
he
this,
gave the language.
Say
he
that.
He said, go a couple blocks
yes.
away and talk to a cop.
I thought they were going to hurt me, so I had
yeah.
to go, which is always
feared for my life.
Feared for my life. That's bullshit. It's
yes.
gross. And it just shows you, like, this is the mentality of police. This is how they approach us as protesters when we are in the streets, is this. They're so heavy-handed. Like, I can't
I
even, like...
say it. You came home from Minnesota with a bruise.
Oh, yeah, because they do shit.
They
like,
they'll
pinch you when nobody's looking and want you to react, or they'll stomp on your feet when nobody's looking so that you'll react to that, and then they can arrest you for something. Like, they're really, really, like, they have these really, like, insidious tactics that they use that are very physically difficult to take. And so this doesn't shock me at all, but it's I think really cool that he got caught, because it puts a lot of things, like, first of all, why would you put that on Facebook?
Yeah,
like, why
in the public? And that's just
so stupid.
Public
people,
because he thought he would get away with it. He's like, oh, I'm just telling him how to do my I'm doing my job. He felt righteous.
Ugh. Yeah, and then that's the thing, Drew. They feel righteous, and it's just one of those things where this is normally strategically how it runs. It's
yep.
not like he's saying something that's surprising to
right.
people. And
yeah.
also, it's just one of those things where fear, the person that's fearful matters. White fear matters, black fear doesn't.
Yep.
That's
and that's
truth.
Something people don't want to talk about either. When
Absolutely.
White people get fearful, cops show up and beat the hell out of everybody.
Yep.
Black people get fearful, you can't get them to come to your goddamn neighborhood. It makes a difference.
It's
yeah.
true.
And
it's
cops,
true.
And I know cops talk about it in training where they literally, if it's not said verbatim, the words "I feared for my life" is your get out of jail free card.
Right.
It's certainly presented that way.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's all you got to do. Feared
for my
life.
Feared for my life.
Feared for my life.
12-year-old boy, I fell for my life. You know.
Mm-mm-mm. So,
God damn it. Fucking white people.
White people. I get bullied in school. I can't wait till I'm a cop so I can bully you. White people.
Hey.
White people.
You know, side note, we should talk a different podcast, but we'll pin in it, about, like, this whole, like, guilty white. This whole... folks are out there throwing this, like, oh, you're just a guilty white. Like, I'm mocking white people and whiteness and this and that. But, like, I don't feel guilty. Like,
I shouldn't,
like,
feel guilty. What does it feel guilty about?
What purpose does it serve? But that is a, that seems like a right wing nut job, like, you know, alt right area, weapon of the de jure is this, oh, you're a guilty white.
Yeah,
this fucking beta male conservative guilty white motherfucker. Anyway, so go ahead.
No, I was about to say, and the sad part about it, Drew, is that something I was thinking about this, and I was particularly thinking about you when I was thinking about this, is one of these things where when white people are enlightened and white people begin to think outside of themselves and have empathy and sympathy and compassion for people outside of them, they begin to get treated just like the minority that they care about. No, it's not on the same level, but they are ostracized. They are a lot of times put outside of their groups, put outside of their social circles, and they're considered outcasts for actually caring. And I think that that's sad, because any minority group that has had any push or any change in our country has had to have somebody outside of the group that's not directly affected to care and to march with them. The civil rights would have never happened without white people. There were white people that actually died, got hung, got beat, and all that shit, just like black folks, because they cared. And it's amazing how caring can get you to the point where people that look just like you think there's something wrong with you for caring.
When it's, I think it, you're right. I'm not refuting any of that. It seems to me more like cult behavior. You know, I've talked, right. I sometimes refer to supremacy as a cult. You know, it's like indoctrination into a cult of thinking, supremacist like language and feeling and acting and behavior. But when you, in any other cult, when an individual leaves the cult, that's the immediate action of the cult members is ostracization, cut them off from everyone else.
Right.
You know, you're no longer a part of the group and we're going to make fun of you and mock you and all these other things. But, I certainly, you know, I think, yeah, you know, it is what it is. I think folks that are going to hate are going to hate. Like, well, anyway, but what were we? What was our white people this week?
Yeah, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Mary Kay Letourneau, and I thought Karen would be a good person to discuss this with.
How long ago was that?
So it's 20 years.
20 years.
Since the original teacher-student scandal hit the United States, February of 1997. She was caught having a sexual affair with her 13-year-old student, Vili Falau, for those who don't remember. She was arrested and was pregnant in 35 with Falau's child at the time of her arrest.
And there was a bunch, like, he got out on bail or bond and then was caught with her and had to go back.
He was a child babe. She was
out on bail or bond.
She gave birth to the baby in jail, and they let her out of prison early. She pleaded guilty to 2 counts of second-degree rape. They let her out after serving 80 days because she had just had the baby with the stipulation that she couldn't see him anymore. October of 1998, the following year, she was caught with him and also pregnant by him again. When he was just shy of his 15th birthday, she served her sentence, and after they got out, they got married in 2004. And they now have been married for 10 years. I want to talk about it because I found it really disturbing the way folks talk about this particular story. I don't like to speculate about other people's lives, but when I hear Vili talk, it just kind of makes me a little like, I don't even know. I'm going to play a little bit of a clip. Barbara Walters interviewed them for their
shocking headlines almost 20 years ago when she had an affair with a then 13-year-old student.
Just stop for a second.
Serving seven.
Yeah.
Even and I think there's a huge, I don't say double standard.
It is a double standard.
But when it's men,
yeah,
and the female is the perpetrator, I guess is the right word here. They just call it an affair. They didn't call it rape. And she went to jail for rape.
Yep.
She served time for statutory rape. The word is rape. That is the correct rape. Adjective, verb, whatever you want to call it, in this sentence.
Yes.
Yet here she is interviewing it and calling it an affair.
Yeah. Calling it an affair. This is what I want to talk about, is the way this story has been.
The narrative,
the narrative that how people present it.
She's now 53, he's 31, and on the eve of their 10th wedding anniversary, Barbara Walters sat down with them. I spoke with Barbara about her exclusive interview airing tonight on 2020. Barbara, hold on. This story continues to fascinate.
Well, when I mentioned to people that I was...
So it's not a story. So yeah, that's right there. It's not a story. Okay.
Doing it. Everybody seems to remember, this is the school teacher. She served 7.5 years for her relationship with him. And now they've got...
No, she served 7.5 years for raping a 13-year-old boy.
She served 80 days.
For raping him the first time.
The first time.
Yeah.
At this big 10th wedding anniversary from the story that still shocks people. How could she do it?
Right. And they're still together.
Yep.
So
they're still together and they have two teenage daughters. Born when she was in prison, serving prison for the child rape.
And you reminded me of something, that she went to prison not once, but twice.
Yeah.
Because they said, look, go to prison for a year, but stay away from them.
And she couldn't stay away.
Couldn't stay
and
away.
So then they said, okay, now you're going to serve your whole sentence. And people thought that this was, I mean, there are still people who are shocked and disgusted, but, you know, they've been married 10 years. They've got two teenage daughters who think that this is, they're unfazed. You know, this is mommy and daddy. They seem to be okay. You'll meet the daughters tonight. I wanted to keep it a secret.
Yes. Well, and I want to show, if you don't mind, a little clip of the secret from your interview. Take a look.
I don't know if enough time will ever pass where it will take away what the media did to our story, because it was so big and they ran with it so fast. There's a story of us that has a life of its own, but it's not our story.
Villa, you became a father when you were just 14 years old, and again the following year. Tell me about that time and what role you've had in your daughter's lives.
It was a huge change in my life, for sure. I don't feel like I had the right support or, you know, the right help behind me.
From your family?
From anyone. In general, I mean, my friends couldn't help me because they had no idea what it was like to be a parent. I mean, because we were all 14, 15.
It has not been an easy road for you. You suffered from depression, yes?
A lot. It's a feeling where it's like there's this hopelessness. You know, you just feel like you can't do anything. You know, like nobody understands you. You can't talk to anyone. I wish I just had a little bit better guidance through everything. It was kind of like, it was really confusing to me. We're going to label this kid as a victim, and we're going to make this woman an example for all other teachers who try to go down the same path.
It really is fascinating.
Boy, some of the just the tenor and tone, as you said, was almost downbeat. But he said he wished he had better support. He wished he had better guidance. You know, that's... Oh, man, that's painful to hear.
It's really, like, been just weighing on me a little bit, because I remember this story when it broke, and I remember all the fallout from it. I remember, you know, just having this idea of just, like, this is so weird. And then I also remember when she was released and they got married, me thinking, like, wait a second, like, maybe he was fine. And that now in my adult self, you know, my almost 40-year-old self, thinking, like, no, there's no time in which he was fine. And beyond that, like, this scenario is set up where his actual predator is now his partner. And I just don't know how that can be healthy. And the way that the media has allowed this story to morph, I'm looking at the title of the story. It says, A Look at the Original Teacher-Student Affair.
Affair.
And it's such a double standard. If this was a girl student, a male teacher, there's no way this story could morph itself into them. This is the love of their life and they need to be together and blah, blah. Like, it could never happen. It could never happen. And this double standard really irks me. And I think it goes back to male fragility and the idea of the strong male, especially when it comes to sexual contact and what that means and all that comes with that. What do you think, Karen?
I think for me, like you said, if the roles reversed, there would be no fascination. There would be no praising. There would be a lot of criticizing. The interview would be very harsh towards the person being interviewed.
Yeah.
You know, because when it comes to women committing crimes, period, people act like women are fragile creatures and they do not know any better. When it comes to people that prey on a child is a child, male or female, a child is a child. But for some reason, when it comes to females, they feel like you're quote unquote taking something away from her. But you know what? when it's a woman, you're taking something away from that man. But people don't view it like that, you know. Mm-hmm. It's, you're taking innocence from a child, you know, because when men get sexually abused, a lot of times they withdraw. A lot of times they have sexual hangups. A lot of times it's a lot more to it. But because it's a pressure on males to get all the pussy they can, you know, nobody really ever asks men or asks young boys, how does this make you feel? Are you okay with this? Are you all right with this? You know, all of a sudden it's high fives and you go,
yeah,
boy.
I was gonna say the overwhelming sentiment around Bilal, I remember at the time, and I'm, you know, 40 something now, back then I was 20 something, was just, you know, again, all my peers like, I can't, this is crazy, you know, good for him, you know, high five, I was getting pussy at 13, blah blah blah, like, you know. And I think it was reflected in her initial sentence of being just 80 days.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, you know what? It's no big deal. Like, okay, he got some. Okay, you know, good job, buddy.
Right. And the thing is, you're dismissing the emotional damage. You're dismissing the physical damage. You're dismissing the hurt and the pain, you know, that this young man went through, you know, because it's obviously that he did not get the help that he needed, because if he would have all mean of harm, there wouldn't have been a second time with this woman.
Nope.
Yeah, and really I believe that
if somebody would have stepped in and said, come here, young man, let me help you, let's talk about this, let me show you that this isn't right, because there are a lot of people that are grown now that when you ask them about their childhood were sexually intimate with older people in their 20s to 30s, which technically is statutory rape, but they don't look at it like that, because as far as they're concerned, they quote-unquote was mature enough. You were not mature enough. I don't care what you tell yourself. I don't care what your body says. You were not mature enough at 13 years old to handle a sexual relationship with somebody that old. Now, people within your same, I'm sorry, y'all, that's my computer. People within your same age range, completely different, because then everybody's having awkward sex. Let's just keep that real. But you're talking about somebody that's experienced, somebody that knows better, and somebody that's taking complete advantage of you. And that's the problem. Yeah. You're not treating this like it is. She took advantage of him.
Yep.
Not once, but twice. And then I think, like you say, because she preyed upon him, that's why they got married.
Yes.
She's that control over his life.
Think about for him, his I assume he was 13. Let's just, you know, assume this is his first sexual contact.
Most
His introduction to, so like you said, there's, you know, awkward teens, like everyone, they tell you, how was your first experience? Oh my God, it's ridiculous. You're like, you have all the same awkward, like, attempts at sex that most teenagers have. But him, with an experienced adult, right, let's call it predatory in some way, right? Predatory. His introduction to sex, his first sexual experience, his formation of sex and sexuality is skewed. It's on a basis that's from, you know, statutory rape, from a predatory nature. And I'm with you. I think there's a little bit of, like, I don't want to say Stockholm syndrome's the, you know, technical thing, but, you know, because that's all he knows. And then she serves time in jail, right? So now she's, not only has he got this predatory introduction to sex, but now he's got this sort of like guilt of like, wow, she's serving jail time for me. She's gonna be in jail for many years, and I have this child I have to raise, children I have to raise. It's almost like, you know, well, of course I'm gonna get married. What else am I gonna do? Like, it's like, how many other choices did he have? Right? Like, he's like, people were giving good guidance, but, you know, he got set up to fail. There's a good segue. Is that our dogs? What are they doing?
Yeah, that's our dogs. They're just playing over here.
Enough problematic white dog. Jesus.
Our dog is problematic white.
So a Twitter follower and someone I semi-know, Alex Blank Millard, wrote an article for The Establishment called Male Survivors of Sexual Assault Speak Out. And it's a lot of what you're talking about, Karen, just specifically that I'll read a couple passages. If you call yourself a victim, you're acknowledging that something happened to you and you couldn't control. You couldn't defend yourself or fight back. Men grow up being told we're supposed to be tough. We're supposed to be masculine and self-sufficient. We should be able to defend ourselves and others. My father was teaching me to fight long before I could read. And that was Santonio Hassel, a writer. But so 1 in 33 men have experienced sexual assault or rape. Again, this article is really, really good, and it's talking about you know, just this masculine sense around victimhood and even just the word victim, and the the way that patriarchy reinforces, like you said, having more sex and getting as much poutang as you can, so that you're even conditioned to think of this not as an assault, not as as rape or as being a victim, but as something that was like, oh, you know, I did this, I did that. So there's no real space to kind of recover. And an interesting sort of aside to the article is that in that void, when men aren't talking about this, when there is no space, when society doesn't give men space to talk about it, they're left with different voices, one of which is very toxic. The men's rights activists, sort of, you know, these red pill Reddit kind of weirdos. So, you know, the whole adage about people that are victimized sometimes go on to become victims. I don't know, but I would speculate that's more the case when they can't reconcile with that because they can't even talk about it. You know what I'm saying?
Right, Drew, and I think that there's several things here. Number one, I know they quote unquote had the children, but in the age that we live in, let's just keep this real. Nobody's really talking about how this affects their children, because your mama and your daddy are known for this. Like, so it's just one of those things where I couldn't even imagine growing up as their children, you know, because it's one of those things where it's not like this was secret. Everybody was talking about it. So your mama is known as that teacher that fucks students, you know, that matters, you know. And it's one of those things where you have a damaged father, you have a damaged mother, and then you have these children, you know, children that are raised up in this household. And it's one of these things where, you know, I hope that the children got the help that they need, not trying to be funny, to be able to face and deal with society when this stuff is probably constantly brought up to them, because, you know, people are asses. Let's just keep that real. And people will not let things die. And so it's just one of those things where, unless they did a very, really good job of shielding them.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, this has had to be something that, hey, they've had to deal with on their everyday thing. And to piggyback on something you said before, Drew, a lot of men, and people don't want to admit this, that are sexually abused like this, they end up turning that frustration, because since they can't talk to anybody, into anger. Mm-hmm. And they end up beating women, and they end up beating other things. They end up beating their children. They end up fighting, you know, like, because men and women deal with things a little bit different.
Yep.
And so it's just one of those things. Men are taught when things happen, anger is an emotion.
Absolutely.
They're never taught that sadness is also an emotion. Yep. Compassion is an emotion too. They've never, you know, because when it, Amir Rogers talked about this before on the show, when it comes to things that affect women, you know what women do a lot of times? Call their girlfriends and talk about it. Mm-hmm. Okay. Dudes don't do this.
Nah.
Dudes don't call up their boy and be like, hey, dog, I'm dealing with something. Let's talk about this. Now, some men, when they get older, they will. Because it was like, hey, dog, something bothering you, let's talk about it. Because they're to the point where they're mature enough to understand life and understand the reality of life is that you can't let this shit sit on your heart or you will explode, men or women. And it's just one of those things where, you know, dudes will know each other for years and not know not know their boy is married, not know how many children they have, you know, because like, hey, dog, how you doing? It's very casual with men. You know, in their relationship. Now, they do have people, you know, that they really have a tight friendship with. But, you know, on the average, when women go through things, let's get a glass of wine, girl, let's go out to eat, let's take a vacation, girl, let's talk about it, let's get your feelings out. Boys are not taught, let's get your feelings out. I wish more men were taught, let's get your feelings out. And let's get your feelings out does not mean you're gay. It does not mean you're homosexual. It does not mean you're less than a man. You are a human being. And that, and I think that frustrates me. Men are not allowed sometimes to be human beings.
They aren't. It's true.
You know, what you just said just really resonates. That there's a lot of truth in that. And, you know, I'm not, I don't want to talk, I'm on the podcast about it, but I use the word victim, on myself, and only recently. And I, you know, I've been married to Leslie now for 15 years, and, you know, I don't speak about it. And, I would say the ability for us to talk about it and the impact that experiences had on me is specifically related to working on sort of intersectionality and working on different understanding oppression and really understanding the you know, the culture like around masculinity and what mm-hmm. that is. Like, even think about like not only are there not words to really talk and there isn't space to talk, think about like you're talking about slavery with a smile. Think of male sexual assault, and when you ever and only hear about it, it's like prison rape jokes.
Right.
It's like, you know, and it's used like a comedic bludgeon, like, yeah, ha ha, you're gonna get butt fucked in prison. Like, there was just a Yes All Cops where one of the cops used that as a threat,
yep,
to get somebody to confess or to snitch on someone else, but like literally was like, well, I'm gonna put you in jail and, you know, they're gonna rape you there. So like, you know, it's a you know, like Karen said, it's human. It just, you know, you're, yeah, allowed to be who you are, and it's been easier for me to have that dialogue with you and you know, just use the word victim at all, as understanding oppression and intersectionality. And
it's true. Alex says in her piece, she says, the set of rules, the framework of our society's toxic construction of masculinity, robs men of the ability to express themselves fully and creates a culture where men commit suicide rather than treat a mental illness, because there's absolutely nothing worse than being quote unquote weak. This is reflected in America's stats on suicide, which show the rate of suicide is 4 times higher among men than women.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, because the truth be told, it is very difficult to be a woman. Women have to deal with a lot of shit that men just can't imagine. But on the other token, men have to deal with things that women cannot imagine. And a lot of times, particularly if you're talking about straight men, you're talking about their quote unquote demanded, particularly if they're married or in a relationship, you're demanded to be the head of the household. You're demanded to be able to, when a woman has problems, she has to be able to come to you and lean on you and depend on you. You know, men are required to have all the answers. You men are required to fix things. And it's one of those things where just like women can't be everything, men can't be everything either. Just like a woman has to learn how to become a woman, a man has to learn how to become a man. And now that he has to make his own definition of what manhood is. And that's the thing. Men are afraid to make their own definition, because your definition of manhood might not be somebody else's definition of manhood. And it's might be one of the things where, as you might be a man, but you know what? You might cry a lot. It don't mean you're not a man, and it don't mean your testosterone don't flow as strong as somebody else's. But society wants to make you weak. And I think unless you get to the point where you grow and you begin to, as a man, begin to break those chains that society has wrapped around you, a lot of men, particularly straight men, will never be able to love their mates and love their children and love their household like they should until they are set free out of these chains that the world has placed upon them.
Yeah.
I truly believe that. You know, it's a lot of hurting men out there, because yes, men, you know, I believe that stat when you say men commit suicide at a higher rate, because you're expected to the be all know all, and that's impossible for any human being to do.
You know, and all those different, you know, those are gender roles and societal roles and different things. These, you know, Alex called them rules, toxic rules. In Argentina, and they're all very much similar, there's not a lot of change, but men are comfortable showing affection for one another. They kiss on the cheek side to side like you do in other European countries, but they'll hug and hold hands. And there's a closeness that men have. That it's just it's Argentinian. I can't describe it, but it is a closeness. And I honestly felt for male relationships, it was it kind of like, I don't know, it made things a little bit easier somehow. I don't know how to describe it, but there wasn't such a, you know, like if you like hug and kiss a guy on the cheek, you're not gonna be all like, oh, you know, machismo. You know what I'm saying? Like it was a little bit different atmosphere and culture around masculinity. And again, sort of like the sort of difference in double standards. And, you know, I think we're only in the last 30 or so many years, we've seen the dialogue in terms of experimentation with, you know, same sex relationships on the female side. Now it's almost like passe or cool. Like, oh, I had a lesbian phase in college. Like, oh, that was a cool thing to do. You would never say that about a dude. You know what I'm saying? A dude say, oh, I had a homosexual phase in college. That wouldn't be like, oh, cool, that's awesome. You know, it's a very different. But why, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. It definitely, part of that just, again, goes back into, you know, those rules around masculinity and what's,
right,
you know, what's acceptable, what's not. And then there's also this aspect of just like erasure. We just talked about this. That's why I wanted to bring up this article, is because when I started thinking about Billy and Mary Kay Letourneau, I couldn't help but think about him in those moments after, in those years after these encounters with her, where, you know, he was never pitched as a victim, even though in the eyes of the court he was. In, yeah, the media, that's not the narrative that was pushed forward. So I imagine for him, even if he felt like one, he never was even given space to be one. And then he was a father, and then he's permanently connected to this woman.
Right.
And then she gets out, and what is he to do?
That's my point. I just feel like there was no, he had no other journey than this outcome. I'd be shocked if he's had relationships with any other woman. And that,
oh gosh, you're probably right.
If he's never been with another woman, how does he even know if he likes what he likes? He likes what she likes.
Wow.
He likes what she said she likes. He likes.
Right. And he's never allowed to sexually develop.
Yep.
And not at all.
And a lot of times that was literally yanked away from him. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those things when you talk about those things, that's something, like I said, back to that manhood thing that people don't want to talk about, because when it comes to victims, it's one of those things society acts like men can't be victims. But men can be victims too. But a lot of, especially sexual crimes, are committed, you know, statistically against women. And it's one of those things where, you know, women, when we're victims, we're blamed.
Yep.
We're taught to walk in packs and it's your fault, what do you have on, all that stuff. You know, when men are victims, they aren't treated in that same manner, which is sad, because it's just one of those things where, you know, men are not taught to walk in packs for their own safety. Men are not taught to protect yourself from other men, because most men feel like they have the ability to defend themselves and they have the ability to take care and handle the situation. But it's one of the things where when you become a victim, all of a sudden that quote unquote strength that you're supposed to have is gone. And the thing about when people are victims, men and women, they don't want to believe that they're victims.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So instead of, because the thing about being a victim, you have to accept the reality that something happened, like you said, against your will, that you had no control over. If you don't accept that, there's no healing. There's no moving on. Mm-hmm. There's no being that, you know, because it's a lot of people that have been victims of things, that have become the biggest advocates, and that has caused laws to change so that this does not happen to anybody else.
Yep.
But they had to accept it. Not only did you have to accept it, you had to accept it. You had to face the reality of it. You had to embrace that it happened. You couldn't be in denial. And you had to get to the point where a lot of people, where you didn't cry anymore. And I don't mean that in a bad way, but for some reason, when it comes to victimhood, and I've talked to many women, when I've talked to them, they talk about rape like it's second nature. Oh yeah, I was raped, and they move on. There's no crying. There's no tearful thing. Mm. There's no breaking down every time. But for some reason, when you say I am a victim, people expect you to go back to that moment like it happened yesterday. Like you can't move on past that point. Everything in your life is connected to your victimhood.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absurdist Words is quoted, and he's a person on Twitter that I follow, and he's great. And if you don't know Absurdist Words, I'd follow him. He's wonderful. But he said, there's a common sentiment that victim is an insult. It's used to describe a state of perpetual weakness of character and self-perceived subjugation. In essence, this is a way to shame people for being abused. Denigrating people from victimhood is about denying people the space and empathy required for recovery. And then his last piece I wanted to read, which was really good.
Well, he says at the end, he says, as with advice, and this is a great thing to kind of finish up with, he says, it's not your fault that you were harmed. You did not fail at being a healthy human. Your abuser did. You have nothing to be ashamed of. And Santino, who drew a quote earlier, says to fellow victims, he says, it's not your fault, no matter what you were doing or wearing or drinking. It's not your fault. No one had the right to attack you. No one had the right to use your body. Nothing you could have done differently would it change the fact that your attacker is a rapist. You're not alone. So,
and I'm sure for his last piece, I did not do something wrong. Someone else did. I refuse to accept that my victimization should bring me shame. I think those are both great.
Absolutely. Well, Karen, I want to say thank you again for joining us. I know we had some heavy subjects, but I always like to get you on to talk about them because you always have such amazing insights to share and you always have bring so much to the table. So hopefully that was okay.
Thank you. And I didn't mean to scare nobody off. But
no.
Thanks. Where, you know, you just see a lot of things. Not the wow. You just shut up.
Absolutely. So tell everybody where they can find you. And, you know, I would just say that literally I watch or listen to or watch the Black IO Tips every single 5 days a week. I don't miss it. It's my favorite podcast. And it's just an amazing show. You guys really have the perfect mix of humor and pop culture and important subject matter and guests and everything. And it's such a great show. But tell everyone where they can find you and listen to the show. You guys are on Wednesday through Sunday. Or is that right? No.
Friday, Saturday, Sunday.
No, Saturday through Wednesday. I got it right.
Well, there's a show Friday, but you got to be premium.
Yeah, that's why I said Saturday through Wednesday, they're on live. And then they have premium shows as well. Of course, we're premium, so. Mm-hmm.
But so where can they find you?
They can find me over at theblackguywhotips.com. Everything about us is over there. I do a show, like they said, 5 days a week with my husband. But the motto of the show is nothing's wrong. Is this fun? Wait a minute. Nothing's wrong if it's funny. I've been doing the show and I screwed the motto up. And we it's jokeful and laughter. If you're easily offended, it ain't the place for you.
Facts.
You know.
If you're a Bernie Sanders stan, it's not the place for you.
Yeah, if you're a Bernie Sanders stan, just stay away from everybody.
And it's funny though, we actually have a Bernie Sanders fan that's actually a fan of the show. Coolest person ever. It's several Bernie Sanders fans that are cool people. It's just the small little percentage that they're fruitcake crazy. You can find my husband on Twitter at Rodimus Prime. You can find me on Twitter at Say That Again, that as in DAT. And everything about us is over at The Black Guy Who Tips. I had a good time. I enjoyed it. It's always fun to be on with you guys.
Oh, we love having you. And I had this queued up earlier, but I thought, yay, can we have you? And I have my good sound effects. But thank you so much for being on, and we absolutely love the show. And I'm sure a lot of people that listen to us found us through the Black Guy Who Tips.
Yes.
So thank you for that. You guys are always just tremendous. Always a pleasure.
Anytime.
You guys are great. That's your cue, Drew.
Good night, everybody.
High five.